of unconstitutional surveillance continuing, that which goes unreported by the intelligence agencies, justified in the name of national security.
I would go further than to say the possibility. We know that secret, unaccountable, unconstitutional mass surveillance continues. That is a known fact. And unfortunately, the reforms that have been enacted to date don't fully address the problem. There will be opportunities, however, for Congress to continue addressing those issues and for courts to continue addressing those issues. There will be opportunities, even as we've seen in the press recently from the national security agencies, for whistleblowers to also contribute to the public discussion of these questions.
All right, we're going to leave it there. Again, that's Shahid Buttar with the Electronic Frontier Foundation. Thank you so much for joining us today on Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio.
Thanks for having me, Kevin. It's always great to talk to you.
And that wraps it up for another edition of Flashpoints. Our executive producer is Dennis Bernstein. Our roving producer and producer of Flashpoints in Espanol is Miguel Gavilan Molina. Our technical director is Mike Biggs. Our guest host and senior producer is Kevin Pina. For more information about the show, to listen to or download archived episodes, log on to flashpoints.net. For questions or comments about Flashpoints, you can contact Dennis at dennisjbernstein@gmail.com. Thank you for listening.
It's 11 o'clock. You're listening to KBOO Portland. Coming right up, it's the bike show. Alon has several guests today by telephone and a new host to introduce. And this KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from City Bikes, a worker-owned, cooperatively run, new and used bicycle sales and service shop with two locations on Southeast Ankeny near KBOO. Open 7 days a week for your bicycle commuting needs and online at citybikes.coop.
It takes two wheels and no gasoline to keep yourself healthy and to keep the air clean. You can ride in the sunshine, you can ride in the rain. It takes two pedals, two wheels and a chain. Everybody, ride your bicycle. Let's get together and leave our cars home. Everybody, get on your bicycle. Let's get together to pedal and roam. You can take a ride up in Forest Park. You can ride with the light.
Good morning and welcome to the KBOO Bike Show. My name is Alon Rab and I'm joined in the studio today by our new co-host, Alexandra Zimmerman. We're very happy to have you on board. And welcome to the show, Alex.
Thanks, Alon.
Quickly, maybe you could tell us about some of your connections to cycling.
Sure. I work in the bike industry right now. I am in marketing for one of our local bike companies. I've done some community outreach as well, interned with the Street Trust over here. Prior to that, I coordinated university bike programs at the University of Utah.
Thank you. That's great. And welcome again. And our engineer is Tammy Dean. Good morning, Tammy. And thank you, as always, for doing such good work. Since our last show, last month, so much has happened in our city, including the murder of two brave men and the wounding of a third, three good souls who rushed to help Muslim teenagers harassed on a city train. To the families of Rick Best and Telesin Mardan Namakimetra, we send condolences. And to Micah Fletcher, we send a speedy and complete recovery. Also, speedy healing to Rachel, and a warm welcome to Jim and Jenny Hibbert. Jim rode his bike and advocated for their increased use in Portland in the 1960s and 70s. The month has also been one of terror attacks across the world, bombings by armies, and the U.S. abandoning the Paris Climate Accord, an act whose message is a clear declaration of war on the planet and all her inhabitants' future. Amidst the carnage, greed, lack of caring, it is important to remember all those who are working to make our home, the earth, a more sane and just place. And in this effort, also the bicycle, that modest means of personal and global transportation and transformation, and its essential role. Our guests today are two historians, writers, and activists who have devoted time and effort to studying the limits and also the potentials of bicycles as tools for radical change, and have also been in the forefront of critical and thoughtful analysis and activism, helping us move to that world we carry in our hearts. In the first part of the show, we will talk with Chris Carlson, who is in San Francisco, and in the second half with Sarah Riboloso Mikala of Davis. I'd like to start with a quote here by our first guest. Cycling is our starting point. Cycling is the window that we open to a new world. But if we stand in front of the window and simply stare, admiring the beautiful wooden frame, the work of painting, the light that shines from the glass, we abdicate our responsibility and miss a great opportunity. We have to go through the window to realize that on the other side, the changes that we hope to embody cycling involve much more than transport. These words were written by our first guest, San Francisco historian, writer, university teacher, and activist, Chris Carlson. A co-founder in September 1992 of Critical Mass, he is the author of the books After the Deluge and Nowtopia, editor of six books, including Critical Mass, Bicycling, Defiant Celebration. Welcome to the show, Chris, and thank you for being. I'd like to start with the question about the recent World Bike Forum you attended in Mexico City. Could you tell us a little bit about this forum, its history, its goals?
Sure, yeah. The World Bike Forum started in 2011 in Porto Alegre in the south of Brazil. And it started because they had had the unfortunate experience of having an enraged banker drive his car through Critical Mass, and sort of like the parting of the waves, with several hundred bicyclists just being thrown off the hood of his car. And it was a really grisly video that you can still see online, and it was a very horrifying experience. Luckily, nobody was killed. It's unbelievable, and also nobody was suffered any lasting damage. So, I mean, there were many broken bones that night. So anyway, a year later, they decided to call the world to Porto Alegre to dramatize the fact that there was had been no support for them, that there had been no criminal prosecution, etc., against this vice president of a local bank. So a bunch of us came down there to participate in what they called the first World Bike Forum, and it was more of a South American bike forum than a World Bike Forum, but there was a few of us from other countries and other parts of the planet who showed up, and that event then has now gone on for 6 years in a row. It went from Porto Alegre to first 2 years, and then the third year was in the city of Curitiba in the south of Brazil also. I went to that one as well. And then the fourth year, it finally left Brazil. There's a really fun and kind of hilarious election process at the end of each event because it's super grassroots forum. It's not like Velo City or any of these big commercial events. It's actually pretty much activists, some academics, but mostly activists and people involved in the cycling culture across the board. And it's a pretty high representation of women, unlike many of these events as well, which is one of the things that makes it so enjoyable. And so at the end of each one, there's a sort of wrap-up session in which people nominate themselves from other cities to host the next one. And there's a big kind of hilarious series of five-minute presentations and then arguing and discussion and backroom lobbying. It's kind of like the smoke-filled room. And then
sounds like fun. Yeah,
it's pretty fun. And then there's a vote, and then usually it's a two-round vote. So there might be like this year we had four cities who've nominated themselves. It was Moscow, Vienna, Madrid, and Lima to host the one in Quito for 2018 because it's already going to be in Lima, but for 2019, and it was Quito that won the vote and just barely eking out Moscow, who actually won the first round. So it was very fun, and that's how this thing moves from city to city. So the fourth one was in Medellin, the fifth one was in Santiago, Chile. I went to that one too, and then this year was in Mexico City. So it's a gathering of people most of the time in South America, mostly people from South America. But there's people from other parts of the world as well.
And our president probably lobbied to have it in Moscow, I'm sure. So the theme of the conference was handmade cities. What's meant by this phrase, and how do bicycles fit into that?
Well, I think that is a good question, and it's not entirely immediately obvious to people why that slogan might have made sense. But it took on its own personality, as you might expect, and it was actually quite gratifying that they chose that title. I used it. My wife is Mexican, so she gave me a good punning title for my talk. Which, you know, if it's Ciudades Hechas a Mano, which is handmade cities, the title of mine was Ciudades que echan la mano, which means cities that lend a hand.
Mm-hmm.
And so the idea was to try to take this notion of handmade cities, which kind of flows into our rather strong adherence to what some people have referred to as folk politics, that everything should be face-to-face, it should be decentralized, it should be very local, it should be smaller scale, and all these kinds of things. And then, you know, the idea that the bicycle is sort of a more artisanal way of dealing with personal transportation, which is something of a misnomer, in my opinion, since the bicycle is clearly an industrial device,
mm-hmm.
and in many ways was a direct precursor to the private automobile. So people tend to gloss over those realities, and the dark history of the bicycle itself gets left behind, but it's still there haunting us. And so what I wanted to do was really kind of talk about the fact that promoting the idea of face-to-face localism within the context of a bicycling culture is fine. That's a great starting point, but it's not enough. And we really do have to start thinking about how to take this concept of kind of the cultural commons that we experience on bicycles and extend it to a physical commons, that we need to have an urban commons that provides a very good life for everyone as a guarantee of human existence, not just humans, but all species. We want to have an urban life that's not entirely, you know, human-centric, but actually make space for other critters and other life forms to coexist with mm-hmm. us as best as we can. And so that was essentially the thrust of my comments. But it turned out that a lot of the other participants in the conference were also urbanists of various types and had a similar idea of the social sort of struggles that are going on around urban lives, whether in Mexico City, which is a kind of, you go to that city and it's actually one of the most beautiful and amazing cities in the world, and it's just unbelievable. How does it function? It's just incredible. So many people and such bad water and such bad air, but yet it still retains an incredible spirit and quite a lot of things about it that one would really like, including recently a lot of new bike infrastructure has been put in. There's a kind of an idea of handmade cities being a way for us to approach the transformation of urban life. I think that was really the theme they were trying to get people to talk about. How do we transform urban life towards a more bicycling-friendly world? But bicycling-friendly world, of course, implies many other things, not just bicycling, but a world in which human beings take care of each other and live in community with healthier relationships with the food and water and air and everything else around us, and shelter and transportation and communications, etc.
We'd like to get to that a little later in greater detail, but what I'm curious, what were some of your impressions of cycling in Mexico City? What are some of the groups active? I noticed a mention of a group whose name translates to pedal and attack.
Yeah, they were actually protesting the conference, as it turns out. They showed up on the first night during the inaugural opening in this Plaza Santo Domingo with sort of handmade signs, you know, talking about basically drawing the connection between gentrification and real estate speculation and sort of the mainstream bike advocacy, which is great because nobody hardly wants to talk about that in South America. It's sort of obvious when you live in North America, though, that's one of the problems we face in bike culture, if there is even a bike culture to be spoken about anymore. I guess your show is evidence that there is a bike culture in Portland. I would say we have lost that here in San Francisco. We don't really have bike radio, or we don't have particularly bicycle-oriented events anymore. People doing things because it's fun to do it on bike, that's hardly happening here. I mean, people just use bicycles in huge numbers as transportation, but there's not really a culture around it in the same way. So
speaking
I feel like,
of... go ahead.
Go ahead.
I was going to say, speaking of large numbers of bicycle-related events, we were one of the founders of Critical Mass in 1992. How did that come about?
Well, there was a bunch of us who were daily cyclists in that era, and throughout the late 70s and early 80s, and through the 80s, there was, you know, kind of a sense of tremendous isolation. If you chose to ride a bike, you'd just one of the few, right? Everybody knew each other pretty much. You'd ride down the street, you'd see another bicyclist. Oh, yeah, there's Bill or Jane or whoever. Because you knew each other, because there just wasn't that many cyclists around. And there was a bike messenger culture here as well, which was quite strong and actually persists to this day as a kind of an odd little subculture of its own, working class subculture. But a critical mass kind of emerged out of a series of things that were happening in that period of time. You might recall the first Gulf War came about, and there had been mass protests in San Francisco, and sort of without anybody paying close attention to it, a bunch of people got on bicycles and started scouting for demonstrations, just like riding as a group ahead of the marches and whatnot to see what was up ahead and kind of warn people if there's a big police presence and things like that. Another group rode their bikes from Santa Cruz to San Francisco, 50 strong, just to protest the Gulf War, all that in 1991. And so that was part of what was sort of in the air. And there was also another group of bicyclists called Bay Area Bike Action who were demanding that Golden Gate Park remain a park and not become a parking lot, which had largely been converted. All the streets there were being parked in all day long every day, and there was no car-free part of this park that was assured at any time. So all this is in sort of the prehistory, and then there's actually many more stronger examples of critical mass-like behavior going back over 100 years in San Francisco, but we didn't know that at the time. We found out about all that later. But in the case of the beginnings of critical mass, it really just came about because at my office, which was at the 7th and Market Grant building, there was a lot of bike messengers passing through and a lot of people who rode bikes, and then we had a sort of, we were publishing Processed World in those days. And so we had this radical magazine collective, and we had a sort of a clubhouse scene hanging out at the office. And one of the things that a lot of us wanted to talk about was bicycles and politics. Like, how could we take this clear, healthy choice we were making that just made our lives better to ride a bike and make that into more of a overt and aggressive political statement? And so part of the idea came about just sort of out of the air, you know, sort of everybody's having a beer or smoking a pot or whatever they're doing, and they're just discussing these things. And sort of the idea occurred to some of us, like, why don't we just ride home together once a month in a group? It's that easy. And San Francisco's geography lends itself to that, because financial districts in the east of the city, and everybody goes east to west when they go home at night. So it's pretty easy to sort of go on the main corridor and bag everybody going by with a flyer and say, hey, let's just meet up on the last Friday of September and ride home together. So that's what happened. We put out flyers, a bunch of us, different people put out different flyers, actually, and then enough people showed up on the first ride that it was quite a lovely experience. About almost 50 people showed up, and we rode up the street and went straight to a bar. It was nothing special other than that, really direct. If anybody listening knows San Francisco, we just went right up Market Street, left on Valencia, went two blocks to this bar called Zeitgeist. And that was it. It was the first ride, but it was so fun, and it was so surprising and so euphoric. It just magically, transmitted itself quickly from that moment. And anybody who was in that first ride was quickly telling all their friends, and then they were calling friends in other cities. And I think it was in October or maybe November that in Poznan, Poland, they had a critical mass ride, because some Polish friend of ours who was here called his friends back there, and they said, oh, we'll do that here. That sounds great. And I think you guys in Portland started one pretty quickly, and many, many other cities got the word. And just in those days, it was actually before the World Wide Web was really part of our life. So this was still back in the days of snail mail and phone calls. And that transmitted it pretty well. And then we created a little booklet that said how to make a critical mass, which you can find online. It's easy to look that up and find it and download it. And it had all these bits of advice, which we produced about a year into it, about how to handle the ride and what makes for a good ride and what pretty obvious things make for bad rides, including what we used to refer to as the testosterone brigade, young men who are spoiling for a fight and show up and think the whole idea of critical mass is to create these sort of semi-violent confrontations with people in cars, which always felt like young people who hadn't really resolved their problems with their parents. And so, we were always saying, look, that's such a predictable set of behaviors. Why do it? Why not engage in something that's totally unpredictable? So be celebratory and invitational and show people that you're having a better time than they are. Invite them to join you next month. Who's gonna accept an invitation from somebody who's berating them?
That's interesting. So, I've actually attended quite a few critical mass rides myself, and some have been more celebratory than others. Some have certainly been confrontational, like those you were just describing. Looking back on your involvement in that history, what are some of the achievements of critical mass, and do you ever think about places that it could have gone further? Is it existing as purely just a celebratory system? You mentioned it was an outgrowth of politics and wanting to make a larger connection to that community.
And before you answer, Chris, I just want to say that You're listening to The Bike Show on KBOO Radio, broadcasting from Portland, Oregon on 90.7 FM. And on the web, we're speaking with historian, writer, teacher, and activist Chris Carlson about critical mass, about how cycling could be more than lifestyle choice, and about the vehicle's revolutionary potential to remake ourselves and our world. So, Chris, go ahead, please.
Well, I would argue, first of all, that critical mass never had any goals. There was no organization, and it was never an entity that could have a goal, because it was simply an event. It took place once a month. It never had any other definition other than meeting up once a month. Obviously, people have later taken the tactic of a mass bike ride and applied that to various political protests and other activities, and that's fine. I mean, people can do that. But if you want to be specific about critical mass, at least insofar as it was conceived here in San Francisco and somehow manages to keep riding even to this day, although, frankly, most people don't think it has much reason to, it was never something that had any goals. So other than to assert ourselves, to have space on the street, to say that we're not second-class citizens, that we're actually doing everybody a favor, and, hey, you know, get out of our way. Once a month for 2 hours, we're going to be on the streets, and the streets are our streets during that time. So in terms of achievements, I would say that's hard to answer in that framework. But, you know, clearly the energy, the political energy that critical mass created at the base of society in San Francisco, and which obviously managed to transmit itself in a sort of meme effect really across the planet, because over 400 cities around the world have had critical masses. Some of them are ongoing, some of them are quite dynamic and quite interesting. It's a space in which people meet each other. And my argument always was it's less about bicycling and more about public space. Mm-hmm. In that sense, it's deeply subversive, because the world we live in has essentially reduced everything to the commodity and reduced all space into spaces of transactions. And so if you're not out there to buy something or to work, you should go home and watch TV. That's basically the message of our society. And so there's no just lingering, loitering, hanging out, meeting people serendipitously in public and chatting with them. All that's kind of difficult. And what critical mass did, sort of by accident, although I was thinking about it, but I didn't know that it would work, was to create space of serendipity, a mobile space of serendipity in which people could have different kinds of conversations and different kinds of encounters and a completely different experience of what urbanism could be in the moment during its happening. It doesn't really have too much effect beyond the moment, other than the fact that it permanently changes your imagination of what cities could be. You only have to be in one critical mass once to never be able to think of cities the same way again. So that part of it, I think, is deeply subversive and exciting. And if you don't, you know, sort of achievement-wise, that's probably the biggest thing, is it's changed an awful lot of people's deep subjectivity about what life could be. And it also gave people a lot of practical experiences in terms of how to manage complicated collective activities in the heat of the moment without any central direction. And that was really useful, particularly like when Occupy came along or 2003 protests against the war. I mean, there's so much of this kind of horizontalist logic has entered the DNA of our culture and our political activist culture especially, so that people are really resistant to hierarchies and they're really resistant to authorities and as a general rule. That doesn't always serve us at every moment, obviously, because in some ways you could say that the world we're stuck with today with Trump at all, or Clinton for that matter, is a direct outgrowth of our impotence, our inability to mobilize a large, you know, majority of the population to change how we live. So far, our fantasies of horizontalist spontaneity, et cetera, have not succeeded. They don't actually change how we live. We end up being stuck living the same way to a great extent, except for us who create these pockets of alternatives and, you know, create these, what I refer to in my book, Nowtopia, you know, as these kind of the daily operations that we exist in are really operations of human cooperation and mutual aid. That's life. Then capitalism comes along and tries to turn all those into products for sale. And so every moment we're always in resistance to that. We just can't help that. We want to live a freer life, a life of based on, you know, the generalized abundance that lives around us and taking care of each other and having a good life. That's sort of our human instinct. And then we get trapped in these relationships that really kind of combat that. And critical mass is one of those brief moments in our lives where we completely escaped the logic of buying and selling and that kind of pecuniary mentality. And that, I think, is super powerful for, on the long term. And, of course, it did lead to politicians going, oh, my God, look at all these bicyclists. Let's give them some infrastructure. And so they start putting in these pathetic painted bike lanes. And, you know, there's always the liberals are always out there, and they all start their bike advocacy organizations, and they want to go and sit at the table of power and make deals with the city and get budget, you know, monetary streams of dough, essentially, to change cities. And some of that's been for the better, and some of it's probably not that important one way or the other. So that's kind of how I think about that question.
And you also mention in some of your writings how bicycles have been used to sort of increase gentrification, displacement of poor people, people of color. Can you explain a little bit about that process?
Well, as, you know, it sort of builds off what I was just talking about, is that you've had this, you know, rise of advocacy organizations who essentially derive their ability to grow on the energy that was created at the base of society through critical mass, as I would argue. So they would say, oh, that's ridiculous. Critical mass had nothing to do with it. We did all the hard work. We went out and signed up all these members and blah, blah, blah. But the idea that there was this turn to bicycling in the culture at large has happened because of the phenomenon of critical mass emerging and then being adopted by literally hundreds of thousands of people across the planet over a very short period of time. And then in the experience of critical mass, many people chose to start bicycling every day. And then when they start bicycling every day, many of them, their politics are not anything close to what I'm talking about, because there was never an agenda you had to sign up for. There's no training camps. There's nothing to impose a certain state of mind or frame of reference or political line on anybody. So most people are liberals at best. You know, they just think, well, the state's fine and just want to have nice people running it and everything will get better. And if we have better, you know, taxes are spent on better things rather than worse things. I mean, who could argue? Better is better than worse. But what you get is these bike organizations, and we have one here in San Francisco, the San Francisco Bicycle Coalition, which have grown enormously over the last, really after the turn of the century, and you know, in the 21st century, they got a lot bigger. And it was their deliberate goal to get bigger, and they did it in order to build a hierarchical organization that could wield electoral power at the ballot box. And then in doing that, they narrowed their agenda so much that all they care about is bicycling. So as a result, they go out and make deals with neoliberal luxury condo developers who say, oh, look, we can make a lot more money on our condos if we can get that bike group to come in and support us, because first of all, we'll get political cover from the bicyclists that we're a green building, and we'll be able to not build parking lots under our buildings, which will save us lots of money. And then we'll attract this new hipster crowd that wants to live in the urban environments and work for tech companies, and you know, spend really top dollar for rent. So okay, this is a winner of a solution from an urban development point of view. And the bike groups in general are oblivious to this problem. They refuse to deal with it. Now some people are beginning to realize what's happened, and they're changing that. And of course, lots of folks of color in different communities, and especially in Southern California, have emerged to contest this logic and really try to put a cramp. And we have a couple of groups here in San Francisco too that are trying to deal with that. But it's pretty overwhelming, instead of, you know, it's sort of an inexorable logic of vast amounts of capital flowing in, and it really does present itself as a pretty insurmountable obstacle a lot of the time. So in San Francisco, the culture of the city has been drained away for the last 20 years, and it's very hard to find where you could feel excited about what's coming down the road, because you can't live here anymore. You just can't, unless you have cheap rent from a long time ago, or some way of getting cheap rent. You basically have to work all the time. And if you're working all the time, you're definitely not engaged in any kind of cultural creation or political creation or interventions of any sort. So this is definitely the new model. And unfortunately, bicycling as a phenomenon has been co-opted by that logic. It has not been an opposition to it. It's been a participant in it.
Well, somehow our time has just been flying here. We have about a minute or two. Are you optimistic about the future? Let me ask you this big question here so early in the morning.
Sure. Well, I'm always optimistic that human beings are incredibly creative and innately free and can do something completely different than what we've been doing up till now. But the basic question is, we get up every day and we participate in the world as we receive it, because it's very hard to do anything different. But that's what we really have to figure out how to stop doing. Like, we need to make the new world we want to live in. And we could get up tomorrow and make a world that's really fun to live in, takes a lot less work in the long run, although in the short run it'll take a lot of work to get there. And that it provides everything that everybody wants. There should be just enough of, there is enough of everything for everybody, so generalized abundance should be the goal, without a lot of work, working with natural systems, dealing with ecology, and that's something we could do. That vision is just like pregnant in so much of our activities, and yet we have a hard time articulating how much better life could be than the world we're in. We're stuck in a stupid discourse in which everybody says, oh, this is the best it could possibly be. You can't change those things, because if you do, it'll all get worse. No. We have to change all those things, because it can get a lot better. And that's really, I think, why I'm optimistic, is I think eventually that'll catch on and people will say, yes, life can be much, much better than this pathetic shadow that we're living.
Well, that is a great place to end. I wish we could talk for another couple of hours, but this is a KBO bike show. Today we're talking about cycling becoming more than a way to get around. We spoke with San Francisco writer and activist Chris Carlson, whose website, chriscarlson.com, contains more information about his work and ideas. Thank you so much, Chris, and keep being optimistic.
Yeah, you too. Thank you for calling.
Thank you for your important work.
Happy day. Have a great day, everybody in Portland.
Thank you.
Thanks.
And come and visit us soon.
Thanks.
In the second half of the show, we will speak with writer, teacher, and activist Sarah Rebozo Mikala, who is in Davis, California. This is the KBO Bike Show. Good morning again. This is the Bike Show on KBO Radio in Portland, Oregon, 90.7 FM and on the web. My name is Alon Robb, and I'm joined by my co-host, Alex Zimmerman. In the first half of the show, we spoke with historian, writer, and activist Chris Carlson. Our next guest is Davis, California-based writer, teacher, and activist Sarah Rebozo Mikala, whose work pays attention to everyday practices like cycling, and how, with the spirit of generosity and community, they can, in her own words, stretch our typical ways of moving about the world. Welcome to the show, Sarah.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Before we start with, you know, finding out about your research and activism, I'm always curious how people came to cycling. What are some of your early cycling experiences and memories?
Well, I'm a little embarrassed to say that it took me quite a while to learn to ride a bike in the first place. I mean, not that long, relatively speaking. I finally summoned the courage when I was about 8, and did, like most people, riding around town. But I'd say I really got into cycling when I lived in Wyoming, and it was much more from the sports side of things. I did road biking and mountain biking, and I also biked around town. As long as basically it was about 20 degrees, I would bike. And it was when I moved to Davis, it was really interesting to move to a place, obviously that is very bike friendly. But my real motivation was to learn how to fix my bikes. And it really was through bike repair that I think I came to see cycling as more than just something to stay fit or to get around.
Among some of the projects that you've worked on one called Remaking Streets. And how do you think that process affects communities? Maybe you could talk a bit about the benefits and also the limitations of using bicycling as a tool.
Yeah, definitely. So as I was kind of saying there, I think it was really working in bike repair that taught me that bikes could be a tool for community building, beyond just sort of like we all like to get together and ride, a proposition that's nice but fundamentally very privileged in a number of ways, from having the time and access to and means to do that to a body that's able to bike. But when I was working in the in a bike repair space, the Davis Bike Collective, I realized that the Davis Bike Collective was a space where anyone could come and fix their bike. It was donation-based, volunteer-run, like many DIY bike spaces, you know, across the country and around the world. So as I was working there, I realized that it was probably one of the most democratic spaces that I'd ever been in. Democratic in the sense that I was seeing people from all different aspects of the Davis community in the same space, doing the same sorts of things, exchanging knowledge, recognizing each other as equal humans. That's something that I think is very hard to find and rare in our day and age. And it was really great to realize that there are spaces where this could happen. I'll never forget, like, for example, one day there was the mayor of Davis working on his bike next to a person who was homeless at the time and a high school kid. And they're all there swapping tools, doing essentially the same activity. So I think that really, in a sense, when bikes are at their best, it's about something more than just the bike. In that space, it was also about, you know, learning how to use tools and how to work together in a particular way. I think in a broader sense, bikes work well when they help us to do something else. I find myself more and more being drawn to projects that aren't about bikes per se, but more are about bikes as a tool to do something else. Mm-hmm. When I think that bicycling can get into a lot dicier territory, I think as Chris Carlson was saying, is when they end up being tools less for community and more for development and profit, something that is unfortunately pretty common this day and age.
You study with Susan Handy, who's the Director of Sustainable Transportation at Davis, on why people like to bike. Do you have any conclusions about that yet? I know you said that you feel best when the bicycle is helping you to do something other than just bike. And does that seem to be different for different types of people or different genders, different age groups or different backgrounds?
You know, we didn't see a lot of differences across, say, like demographics. What was really interesting to me from that study was that it was positive experiences on a bike was what kept people biking. Mm-hmm. We analyzed the types of positive experiences people had and the types of negative experiences people had, really expecting to see negative experiences have, I think, a stronger impact than they did. Because what we found was that if someone had a number of positive experiences around biking, they would sort of move through negative experiences and be much more likely to come back to biking and still enjoy biking, as opposed to somebody who only had negative experiences. And so I think that if we were to move these conclusions into other areas, I think it would be really interesting to do follow-up work about how maybe certain types of people may be positioned in the world where it's easier for them to have more positive experience. And I say that in a very sort of like sociocultural way. In other words, society kind of sets it up, not so much there's anything innate or ingrained about those individuals.
And who participated in the study, and is it ongoing? Or?
It's not ongoing. We interviewed around 50 people, all that lived in Davis. And that's kind of why I say, you know, it's a small place, just one, you know, kind of like one qualitative study. Mm-hmm. So, but it brought up some really interesting, I think, further questions that could be asked.
And back to the question of, you know, the research about remaking streets. So what is meant by remaking streets, actually?
Oh, that's a great question. You know, I think that most of the time as we move about this world, we work on the assumption that streets are for cars. Streets are our largest public spaces in the U.S. And the fact that this, our largest public space, is dedicated solely for the movement of cars, I think is a fundamental problem. We are sorely lacking in places to have ongoing public engagement. Some public space is crucial to a democracy, to the success of a democracy. And when we allocate so much of that space to the movement of these huge vehicles, it's a real loss. And so when I think about remaking streets, what I'm really thinking about is remaking public space, how can we sort of reclaim streets so that they're not just for the movement of cars, but they're for the movement and interaction of people. It's extremely difficult to have an interaction with another person who's not inside your vehicle when you're on a street. That is very much not the case if you're on the bike or you're on foot or via some other mode where you're not encased in, sort of shielded from other people. And so I think that's what I think about when I think about what it would mean to remake streets. It's really more of a remaking of public space, and creating more of a democratic space.
And you've also researched some radical bike projects. I think you mentioned critical mass, queer-friendly bicycle rides. You talk about pleasures and other sensations manifested in these movements. So how do these connect to changing these spatial politics?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think one that I keep kind of coming around to. I think that there's a real sort of emancipatory possibilities in pleasure. I think the things we find pleasurable, the things that motivate our desires, are a great place from which to work for change. It's a place, it's moving from a place of sort of positivity. It's moving from a place where I think it is easier to have more of a sense of generosity. I think we need those spaces. We need those experiences. And we need to recognize that pleasure can belong to different types of people, can belong to different, say, like, different types of bodies in the world. And so I think I think bicycling is a great place to kind of reclaim that, so that you don't just have to be a sort of like stereotypical sort of biker in spandex to have fun biking. You can bike in all these different ways, do all these different types of things to create community, to create a sort of like sense of vitality and engagement. And that, I think, then from that space of pleasure or fun or desire, I think it's easier for people to imagine what other types of world we might inhabit. Again, kind of, I think, moving back to some of the closing comments that Chris Carlson was making, I mean, we need to be able to imagine another world, and imagining that world from a sense of pleasure, I think, is it's still limited, but a really productive place from which to move.
How do you see us fostering that spirit of generosity and openness in the cycling world?
I think it's through creating the space where we can enjoy that, and I think not feeling really like letting ourselves have that. I think within communities that may be very oriented towards making change in the world, there's a lot to be angry about. and I think sometimes that we, and then that anger can be very productive and very moving, but it also can wear on us. There's a lot of, you know, emotional and mental labor that goes with trying to make change in the world. And so I think that if we can also sort of like let ourselves have moments of pleasure, even though, you know, and I could say more about this, I talk all about pleasure. I don't want to romanticize it too much, because I also think pleasure is never innocent. It's always, like, you know, there's that saying guilty pleasure, and that's not really what I mean. I don't think we should feel guilty, but we should recognize that just because something feels good doesn't mean it is good.
Mm-hmm.
So it's, you know, it's kind of, so the one step would be opening ourselves up to those experiences and those possibilities. But two, I think the other step is kind of like the counterbalance, the countertension, is recognizing why certain things might be pleasurable to us. Recognizing maybe how, like, our life histories may shape that, and why maybe the things that we find pleasurable may not be pleasurable to others. Why maybe sometimes the things that we enjoy may actually, in fact, be hurtful to others. Mm-hmm. And so it's kind of like the movement from, like, you know, letting yourself be in the moment and feel the sensations, feel the pleasure, and the counterbalance, recognizing the sort of context within that that is happening, and that again, usually that context means the pleasure is not totally innocent.
You're also working on a book manuscript, I think, kind of along the same vein of pleasure, but this takes a slightly different tack. You're working on something called Selling Fun, Mountain Biking and the Commodification of Experience. Can you tell us a bit about that and what you've discovered on that work journey?
Yeah, of course. So that's my major research project. For my dissertation, I did a dissertation in a PhD in cultural studies at UC Davis here. I studied the origins and growth of mountain biking. I decided to study mountain biking because I was really curious as a younger grad student about the often disconnect between the sort of sporty world of cycling, something that, as I mentioned earlier, I did inhabit, and this more radical critical mass DIY bike shop kind of world that also really embraced the bicycle but had incredibly different makeup and politics and worldviews, and I was a person inhabiting both, and I kind of wanted to understand that. So originally that's what I was going to study. And then I watched this documentary on the origins and growth of mountain biking called Clunkers, and in it I sort of saw threads of both of those sides of biking in one place, because these early mountain bikers, they were sort of like these countercultural hippie types, really thinking about reimagining the world, but they were also really into sports and pretty athletic. And so I thought, wow, wouldn't it be interesting to kind of go back and look at that particular moment in time when these two things that now we think of as very separate aspects of cycling maybe were a little bit more closely intermeshed. And maybe that would actually help me to understand why, in a sense, they're often so separate today.
How did
how
did mountain biking actually start? I mean, where did it start? Or was it just people riding down mountains?
Well, on the one hand, you could say the original bicyclists, people who invented the bike, were mountain bikers, mm-hmm. in the sense that they rode on dirt roads. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was the early bicyclists that actually started the good roads movement that led to, the nicely paved streets we see today. But if we're really talking about what we call mountain biking today, it started in many different places. There were many people really across the U.S. and beyond, in the U.K. and other places as well, who were taking these old sort of Schwinn paper newsboy bikes, or even beefing up road bikes and riding them on trails. People were doing this all over the place. But where mountain biking really arose as an industry, I'd say, was primarily in Marin County, and then secondarily in Crested Butte, although it very, very quickly spread to all over the world. So I did the vast majority of my research in Marin County and also spent a month in Crested Butte.
Have you met Gary Fisher and admired his wonderful handlebar mustache?
So, yes, I have met Gary Fisher.
And what is the male-female dynamic in the mountain biking, the early mountain biking, world, and maybe today?
So it was definitely a very male-dominated space in the past and continues to be today. That said, there were some really amazing female figures that were absolutely crucial to mountain biking as we know it today. One of those is Wendy Craig. She was one of the earliest riders in Marin County. She also took up mountain biking, although we didn't call it mountain biking at the time. She also took up photography. And so she's responsible for many, many of the images that we have today of some of the earliest off-road riding in Marin County and in Crested Butte, for that matter. She was just an absolutely phenomenal rider in her own right. We also have Jackie Phelan, who was one of the earliest racers, also a female, and absolute amazing athlete, an amazing personality that I think really contributed a sense of, really embodied the ethos of equality that I think a lot of early riders wanted to have, but maybe didn't always manifest. And I think really also her experience, I think, really embodies that tension of what people sort of like said their ideals were and maybe what actually happened in reality. Because, you know, she's an amazing person. You know, wasn't always, I think, treated as well as she should have been by the mountain biking industry and community. And then there's a lot of other, you know, phenomenal early riders. And there's continued to be amazing female riders. I think that the hardest thing is that these women often aren't given the same limelight as their male counterparts. I could go on about that.
Right, that's something that we're still seeing today. We're still seeing a lot of women in different types of cycling groups carve out space for themselves. There was a recent article on the Washington, D.C. Bicycle Association's website called Guys, What the Hell? And that went into a little bit of detail on sexist remarks, the typically macho riding conditions that a lot of women encounter when they are cycling. Do you see any type of growth or change in that environment, or how can we work to change that atmosphere?
So here's what I see is this ongoing, like, tension. I'll give this little, like, ethnographic anecdote from when I was doing my research. I went to the Seattle Classic, this really big bike racing kind of festival around Monterey. And I think Sunday morning when all the races are going off, I decided I was going to watch the starts of the races, and then I was going to attend this women's clinic that they were having. And I already noticed the sort of like fact that they had the women's clinic sort of competing time-wise with the race as making some implicit assumptions about what women's interest in the actual race was. But I thought, okay, you know, that's fine. And as I was watching all of these men, mostly men, go off the starting line, there's an announcer kind of giving color commentary, you know, and basically interspersing his remarks of who's going off next. And he's really embedding his dialogue with a lot of very sexist remarks. In the time I was there, I found myself as a female standing by the sideline, referred to first as a mother, then as a wife. Hmm. And this is corresponding to age groups. You know, so they start up with like the kids and they work their way up to like the 65 plus. Hmm. So I'm first a mother, oh, then I'm a girlfriend, then I'm a first wife, then I'm a second wife, then I'm a gold digger.
Hmm.
And I thought, wow, you know, this is making me feel really bad. Like, I don't really want to be here. And this is literally happening like an hour or two later. I'm sitting in a room with a whole bunch of amazing people talking about all the work the bike industry is doing to try and get more women to cycle and in this really supportive environment. And I'm like, okay, these two things are happening literally in the same space. In one space, I'm being told like I don't belong here as anything other than a sort of like trophy wife and spectator of some sort, and then I'm being told they really want me. Mm. I mean, that's a sort of like really schizophrenic, or I'm sorry, I shouldn't use that word. That's just a very oppositional message that you're sending.
Mm-hmm. And as far as the commodification of mountain biking, what do you see going happening over there?
I'm sorry, can you say that one more time?
Yeah, you also, you know, research the process of commodification of the experience mm-hmm. of mountain biking. What is happening in that realm?
Yeah. So kind of like this is, I guess, one of the reasons why I say, like, you know, pleasure and fun aren't always innocent, is that I think that mountain biking was part of a broader moment in our culture when experience and pleasure became commodified at a new level. It's not like that hadn't happened before, but I just think the level of aggressiveness after which marketers and business started going for providing consumers with an experience of pleasure, and that was what's being sold is not so much the object as the experience that object will give you. Think today of many business. People in business will refer to something called the experience economy, an economy that is built in providing people, say, with an environment that elicits certain sensations, that elicits a certain way of feeling and thinking about yourself. This could be something as simple as just the remaking of like a downtown urban space so that it feels a particular way. And that is actually what's being sold more than particularly, say, like going to X restaurant or Y store. You might happen to go into X restaurant, Y store while you're there. What you're really consuming is being in that space and feeling a particular way in that space. And I think mountain biking is really just, in a sense, like a case study of how that happened. Because what you see in mountain biking is that over time, what is not sold is so much a bike, but more the experience of a ride.
And that this maybe brings us back also to some of the points that Chris Carlson made about cycling in a capitalist society and how culture in general affects our values, our behaviors, you know, our visions. Our time is almost up here. What are you working on now? And also, how could people find out more about your work?
What I'm working on now is something, I'm continuing to work on something called the BC Cultures Project. It started out more as a network of researchers thinking about the intersection of bicycling and culture. What it's kind of evolved into is more of an intense seeking partnership with another bicycling researcher and activist, Adonia Lugo. Mm-hmm. And we are doing work right now at thinking about the professional space of active transportation and so people who really make their day-to-day living advocating or working for better, more bike-friendly, walk-friendly streets. And we're trying to think about what it means to really insert justice into those spaces. What does it really mean to include in a deep and meaningful way the voices of people of color who are already leaders in those spaces, even if unacknowledged leaders? And so I was very, very privileged to work with her and a whole bunch of more amazing people on a event called The Untokening, which was, it called The Untokening because the goal of it was to bring together leaders of color within active transportation to essentially get us all in the same room and talk about if we can stop convincing people that the things we think are a problem and just move forward, what can we accomplish? And it was a really productive start to the conversation. Right now we're trying to figure out what next steps are, talking about hosting another Untokening Fallout event that's more West Coast based. It's just a very exciting project to be working on and working on that and just trying to think more broadly, like beyond just cycling, I think, as Chris Carlson was saying. If people wanted to know more about any of this work, probably the best place to look me up is on my website. It's Sarah, SARAHMCCPHD.com. I welcome people there to find out more.
And we thank you very much for your insights and your great work here in the world. Wish you a good day in Davis. And thank you very much.
Well, thank you so much for having me. And thank you for hosting an absolutely amazing show.
And if you come up to Portland, please let us know. We'd love to see you again.
Mm-hmm. Wonderful. Great.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you. You have been listening to the KBO Bike Show 90.7 FM on the web. The show is also archived on our website, so you could watch all the shows going back, 15 years or so. This is your host, Alon Robb. I'd like to thank my co-host, Alex Zimmerman. This was your first show. We're so happy to have you here.
Excellent.
And looking forward to many good shows. And also I'd like to thank our engineer, Tammy Dean, and mostly our guests who provided us with a lot of things to think about, some critical, some negative, some positive, but always interesting. And we really thank our guests, Chris Carlson and Sarah Bolso McCullough, who shared their knowledge, wisdom, and mostly good hearts and caring. Stay tuned for the next show on KBOO Radio, Jazz Lives. And it's been a really sad month here in Portland with all the murders and violence. May the next month be one without injuries and death, the month of health, safety, and joy. All the best.
sunshine, you can ride in the rain. It takes two pedals, two wheels and a chain. Everybody, ride your bicycle. Let's get together and leave our cars home. Everybody, get on your bicycle. Let's get together to pedal and roam. You can take a ride up in Forest Park. You can ride with the light if you ride in the dark. You can ride from the mountain down to the beach. You can ride on a trail, you can ride in the street. You can ride through a puddle, you can ride in the rain. You can take it on a bus, you can take it on a train. Take a ride to the waterfront or down from the zoo. You can take a ride anywhere you want to. Everybody, ride your bicycle. Let's get together and leave our cars home. Everybody, get on your bicycle. Let's get together to pedal and roam. It doesn't matter if you're big or small. You can take a ride to work, you can ride to the mall. Just keep the sky up above and the ground underneath. Get some wind in your hair and some bugs in your teeth. Everybody, ride your bicycle. Let's get together and leave our cars home. Everybody, get on your bicycle. Let's get together to pedal and roam. Everybody, ride your bicycle. Let's get together and leave our cars home. Everybody, get on your bicycle. Let's get together to pedal and roam.
You are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. It's time for Jazz Lives.